You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. I'm going to be talking to my good friend from across the pond tonight. We're going to be talking with David Amoruso. He has the Gangsters Incorporated website, blog site, and Facebook page. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Gary.
So, David, I'm looking back over here. You are a nationally known expert on global organized crime, which is, I like that idea, and we're going to talk about an organized crime person that's not particularly La Cosa Nostra Mafia or even any kind of Italian mafia. He was his own criminal, but I like these stories about these guys that think big, that go for the big score. And in the past, you've done you are a co-author of the Encyclopedia of International Organized Crime, Mafia, the book the mob wouldn't want published. You write for Mob Candy Magazine, the Tampa Mafia Magazine, Guerrilla Convict. You've been used as an expert by well-known outlets like Vice, USA Today, the BBC, and the Discovery Channel. You work with Paramount Pictures, talking, brainstorming ideas for motion pictures about organized crime, which, you know, there's a never-ending stream of organized crime pictures now on Netflix and Amazon. There's a lot of money going in for content. You are a contributor to our friend Ron Chipisic, I think is how you pronounce that, Crime Beat Radio. You're a crime expert and co-host on that once in a while. Your Twitter feeds are at Gangsters Incorporated Web. That's at Gangsters, INCWEB. You're on Facebook at Gangsters Incorporated and Instagram at Gangsters Inc. That's GANGSTERSINC. You have a blog site, Gangsters Inc. GANGSTERSINC.com. So,
sorry, I thought .org.
Oh, it's .org. Oh, yeah, I see it is .org. Okay.
No problem.
So, anyhow, David is an expert on international organized crime. Welcome, David. I'm really happy. We talked to you once before about, what did we talk about? All of a sudden, I've lost that in my head. Oh, about European, the American mob's influence on European criminals.
Yeah, correct. And we also, I think, talked about the Cray twins from London, the British gangsters. Yeah.
Oh, the Cray twins. Yeah, I kind of wanted to do a little English thing. I've got another guy from England now. I've been talking to. He's doing some writing on the National Crime Syndicate website. So we're Gangland Wire is expanding internationally because organized crime, to keep up with it, is expanding internationally. And we, you know, the La Cosa Nostra Mafia is kind of backing down, and the Ingrata, and how you pronounce that? Ingrata. I could never pronounce that. How you pronounce that, David?
Drangheta.
And Drangheta and the Camorra mobs are kind of getting some strength. And I noticed there was a big bust over in Europe. We won't go into that tonight, but it's a big bust over in Europe on them. And then there's other Russian and other Albanian, probably African, Nigerian, then the Mexican, here in the United States, the Mexican cartels and Colombian cartels are becoming a real factor in American cities. David, I'm curious, do you get any effect from the Mexican cartels? Are they bringing cocaine into Europe? Can you tell about that?
Yeah, we have, cocaine, most of the cocaine we get in Europe, it comes from Colombia still, because they have the direct lines with the Calabrian Mafia, the Ndrangheta, and the Camorra. And you have a lot of these European groups from the Netherlands, Germany, who also have connections to Colombia. So basically they get their cocaine from Colombia, but it does happen that we have Mexican nationals in Europe who actually set up a point of entry for drug distribution from Mexico. So we definitely definitely notice that these gangsters are getting more powerful, these cartels, than they used to be, because they want to be hands-on and they want to make as much money that they can, so they send their own people to oversee the distribution. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, they're expanding worldwide. We'll expect to hear more out of them over in Europe, I got a feeling, because there's just so much money in the narcotics business, and they are really well established here in the United States. Tonight, we're going to talk about a criminal, a professional criminal, a master criminal, if you will, Wilhelm Holeder. Would that be how you'd pronounce that, David?
Well, if you would pronounce it in Dutch, it would be Willem Holeder. And with an English slang to it, it would be Willem Holeder, I think, or Holeder. But whatever you say, it basically everything works fine, because in the Netherlands we have so many tourists, and Holeder is from Amsterdam, so his name probably goes around in various forms, and spoken by various tongues, because so many people come through, and he's a well-known name by now, because Hollywood has made a picture about his life, or about his biggest crime that he's most famous for. So I think, you know, his name will basically be spoken of in various forms throughout the coming years, definitely.
So he has an interesting nickname. What is that?
It's the nose, because he has a big nose.
How big? Have you seen him in person? How big is his nose?
I have seen him in person. I don't think it's that big, but, you know, it's basically a typical thing for a lot of these old school gangsters to get a nickname, because back then it was basically a form of a ritual of, you know, entry into this world where you grew up on the streets, and it basically was known for small things, and it was just too difficult to remember everyone's name, and so pretty soon just his nickname stuck, and he got stuck with the nose. And it's always interesting to have these old school gangsters with a nickname, but basically the story behind it is very simple. He just had a big nose, so that was it. But you can people can Google him on internet and see what he looks like, because there's tons of pictures from his younger days up until now.
Interesting. You know, we had a guy in Chicago, the Chicago outfit. His name was Cherry Nose. Cherry Nose Gioi.
You also had a No Nose, right?
Yeah, Joe Nose. Yeah, John Joe No Nose DeFranze. He was from Chicago, too.
Yeah.
We had a guy in Kansas City. It wasn't his nose, but they called him Ripe. Everybody called him Ripe. It was Tony Ripe, but everybody just called him Ripe. Ripe, and his brother was named Cork, or called Cork. So everybody gets a nickname in that world, it seems like.
Yeah, around the world. I mean, it doesn't matter where you come from. You just get a nickname.
So, you know, when I started Googling him, I think I saw maybe you had posted something somewhere. I saw about this guy, and I kind of looked at him. I thought, well, he sounds interesting, And he kind of, what struck me is his earlier crime was on the Heineken kidnapping. You know, Heineken beer, we love Heineken beer over here. At least we used to when it was exotic. I think we have so many exotic beers now. Back in the day, Heineken was the most exotic beer. And he kidnapped the head of Heineken. I think, was that one of the first times when he really came into public notice?
Yeah, correct. That was his big, you know, if you want to call it that, big break. He was already involved in organized crime, so he had committed some robberies with his crew, and they were involved in kicking squatters out of big houses in Amsterdam for these real estate developers. And at one point in the early 1980s, they got together to plan the kidnapping of Freddy Heineke, who was basically the richest man in the Netherlands at the time. And, you know, the Netherlands is a very small country. It's a very safe country, so this guy, as much money as he had, he didn't really have any security. He had one driver who was with him and who drove him to his work and back and forth, and that was it. So they got together and they planned his kidnapping, and it worked. They got a ton of money from it, and with most of the money, they made about, well, it was basically, what was it, 35 million guilders, which would be, I'd say, about $15 million, $20 million nowadays. Maybe more, by the way, but I'm not sure. I'm not too good at, you know, calculating all those numbers. But it was a real ton of money that they made. And they buried $15 million of the loot in the forest in Amsterdam, and later moved it to other places. They said in France, they had it buried in Paris in a big park there in the middle of the city. But eventually they made off with $15 million, and they basically split it amongst the crew members. And it was invested later on in real estate, in prostitution rackets, in gambling rackets, in nightclubs. And the police were never able to get that piece of the loot. They did get a piece of the, you know, remaining, I think it was about 60%. They got, I think, $20 million was found by police. But $15 million of the money was never found again. So they really made a big break with that money and a big hit. And eventually they were caught by police. But by that point, because they had their money and they went on the run into France, where they were caught and they were eventually imprisoned there for a while before they were extradited to the Netherlands, where they served the remainder of their sentence. But that was really what put him on the map. From that moment on, he was a well-known criminal in the Netherlands. And not just that, but it was basically the crew was led by him and his best friend Cor van Hout. And both men were instantly became famous because there was a best-selling book at that point by journalist Peter R. de Vries, who also was involved recently, or not that recently, but a few years ago with investigating the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, the American girl who disappeared in Aruba. And he wrote a book about about the kidnapping and about everything that came after. And he actually talked to Hollander, he talked to Van Hout. And that story, that book was one of the most sold books in the Netherlands at the time. Just still in history, it's up there in the top. So from that moment on, if you went across the street somewhere in the Netherlands and you mentioned Willem Hollander, everyone knew who you were talking about because he was that famous. So that's really how he got to start.
So this guy, he kidnapped this extremely wealthy man, one of the best known citizens of Holland, the Netherlands, and he actually got away. He got the money. He buried it in different places. They split it up. They got caught. They served their time, but they got to keep all, most of the or an awful lot of the money. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I think Hollander got away with about $3 million, maybe more, and Cor van Hout as well. Basically, they all kept their split, and it was about $15 million in total between five men. So that's a lot of money to divide between these guys, and they were able to keep it hidden. And once they got out, they had it invested in prostitution rackets and in Amsterdam, but also in Alkmaar, and they also invested in a nightclub, Casa Rosso. Most of the people that went to Amsterdam to the red light district might know that erotic nightclub because it's pretty famous around the world. Casa Rosso, it's called. And they also invested in some gambling outlets. So basically, that's how they turned that $6 million in total, because Cor van Hout and Willem Hollander were really turned into bigger criminals at that point. They were already established criminals, but from that point on, using that money, using those millions, they were able to expand their influence and power, you know, exponentially. And they basically became big time crime bosses from that point on. So from they were released in 1992, and when they were released, actually, is a funny story, because they were released and their friends, they held a big welcome home party for them. And they actually, once they made their entrance into the Marriott Hotel, which is a big fancy hotel in Amsterdam, they came in and they played the tune that Heineken used in its commercials. So it was sort of like joking about what they did, what the crime they committed. They were actually just having fun with that. And but basically the reason why, this is also an interesting piece about the kidnapping of Heineken, who was, by the way, he was a big friend of Frank Sinatra as well. Frank Sinatra was a close friend of Heineken. And when Heineken was kidnapped, there was a lot of stories also, why did they pick this guy? Because, I mean, obviously he was very wealthy. But another piece of it is has to do with Hollander's own upbringing. His father worked for Heineken back in the day. but was fired. And when he was fired, he lost his job and he basically became an alcoholic. So for Hollander, it was also a personal issue about getting back at the guy who broke his father and who caused so much pain in his household. And his father was a violent man. He slapped his kids, he slapped his wife. But for Hollander, this might also have been a motive to commit this crime that was, in the end, very heinous because, you know, they kept him locked up. And eventually they got out, so no one was killed. But it really traumatized Freddie Heinicke from that point on.
That's interesting. He really set up, he formed the basis for an ongoing criminal organized gang, if you will, his criminal empire. He set it up with this one big score, was able to invest it, launder the money. Again, and at that point in time, probably they didn't have the money laundering statutes in place. I know we didn't in the United States back then, so it was pretty easy to launder that cash. You know, this kind of reminds me, on a small level, we once busted a, there's a kid came into Kansas City from California. And at that point in time, a lot of young guys were coming from California because there was so much competition in the cocaine business and the crack business. They were coming out to other cities where they had the connections back to California for the high-quality direct from Columbia cocaine. And we popped him pretty early in his career, and he told us that he had been working in Taco Bell. He came to Kansas City. He was a gang member, I think, of Blood out there. He started working at a Taco Bell. And he got enough money together, and he bought maybe an 8-ball, and he cut it a little bit and sold that. Took that money and bought a little more, cut it, sold it. Took that money, bought a little more. He finally was up to buying a kilo at a time, and his plan was to continue to, you know, add dealers slowly but surely, be able to buy more dope until he became another cocaine kingpin. So I bet there's a lot of origin stories like that that we never hear. But this guy's origin story came out of this one kidnapping, which really came out of a kind of a personal vendetta, if you will, from his earlier life. That's a fascinating story. So when he came out of the joint, he had some more criminal skills and I think some more criminal associates. What did he get into when he came out of the joint?
Yeah, that's true. He one of the funny things about Hollander, though, is that he never got involved in drugs. He always said it was too much trouble. He said if you deal drugs or traffic drugs, there's always going to be some argument or there's going to be some bad blood and you're going to all end up killed and stuff. So he never was involved in drugs. But what he did do was, obviously he was involved in gambling and prostitution by running these, properties that, made it possible at that time in Amsterdam and Alkmaar. And eventually he expanded into extortion. And he had, basically because he had such a big name and he had so many connections in Amsterdam and he was a famous name, if you will, he was also able to make friends with certain respectable, legitimate businessmen, some real estate brokers, real estate property tycoons. And he met these guys in these expensive bars in Amsterdam, where basically you had the professional athletes mixing with the gangsters, mixing with successful businessmen. And by the end of the 1990s, he set up this new racket, if you will, in which he basically tricked rich real estate guys, property tycoons, that they were being threatened, that he had heard that these Yugoslavian killers were coming for him and that they were going to kidnap him and hold him for ransom, and that the only person that was able to protect them was Willem Hollander. So if they paid him this much money, then he was able to keep these scary Yugoslavian gangsters who basically had a big reputation for murder and gangsterism at that time in the Netherlands. He would be able to keep them at bay and keep you safe if you just paid this much money. And he worked together with Sam Klepper and John Miramet, two other famous Amsterdam criminals by this time. And these real estate tycoons, they at that point saw Hollander as a friend. They did not see him as a gangster. They knew he was a gangster and they knew his history, and that was all known. But they figured, he was a charming fella. If you met Hollander, he had a lot of jokes. He was just a regular kind of guy, and he was able to put these guys at ease and earn their trust, and they trusted him. And once they paid, and Hollander smelled that they were insecure or that he smelled that they were weak, he went in for the kill. And basically what he did was he told them that he needed more money. And at one point, it became clear to these guys that it wasn't any Yugoslavian killer that was after them, but it was Willem Hollader. And that was maybe even worse because they realized that they had nowhere to run, and this guy knew everything about their life because they had trusted him, and he had come to their family's homes, and they went to the gym with him, so he knew everything about them. And by that point, he began extorting millions of euros from these guys because, you know, where were they going to go? He had made it so that he made them invest in certain ventures that he had set up, which were basically semi-legal, so that if they went to the police, that they were seen as co-conspirators. So he basically had them trapped, and he had them shaking in their boots, and they just paid up the money. So that was his next racket, really. So he made millions more by basically extorting a select group of real estate tycoons in Amsterdam and in other parts of the Netherlands.
Well, it's amazing what greed will do to a man that gets him involved with a guy like this, because I'm sure that he played on their sense of greed, that if they worked with this guy, they'd be safe and they would maybe be able to slide by some rules and get some zoning permits. I don't know how it exactly probably works about the same over there, but somehow this guy, he's like the outfitter in Chicago or the mob in New York City, working with construction people and real estate developers, and they can make ensure they have no problems with unions or contractors or the government or anything like that. And once they get in bed with them, then they open themselves up to even more extortion. And so he added another little bit of extortion on top of it. He would protect them from being kidnapping. That was quite a scheme he had.
Yeah, and it was a fake kidnapping because it wasn't real. There was no other gangster making any plans to kidnap these guys because most gangsters didn't even know these people. And there was one guy especially who, like you said, most of these guys, they try to basically play with these gangsters. They basically work together to, you know, basically benefit from the gangster's power and influence. And there was one guy who was one of the Netherlands' richest men, actually. He was in the top 500 of our type of Forbes magazine. It was Quote magazine. But he was on the 36th place as the richest guy in the Netherlands. He had 350 million euros. And he made his fortune, of much of it, by working together with a lot of these drug dealers. Several various gangs in the Netherlands, and he would take their money and use it to invest in real estate. And his property empire just expanded and blew up from the 1990s up until the 2000s. And he was able to just get really rich by doing that. And he was actually one of the guys who was eventually extorted by Hollader because he trusted him, and he was trying to make ends meet by playing one side against the other, and he just got caught up in his own tricks, and he realized that, you know, he might have played with these gangsters, but he wasn't a gangster himself. So in the end, he was no match for them. So what happened was Hollader was extorting this guy, and he's called Willem Enstra. So we have Willem Hollader and Willem Enstra, both Willems, because it's a usual name in the Netherlands. And Willem Hollader was putting so much pressure on Enstra that at one point Enstra decided to talk to the police. And not just that, but he also kept notes. And when he talked to police, they were actually taping these conversations as well. So Enstra was trying to make that move from being a criminal himself to becoming an informant, to becoming a cooperating witness, to making sure that the whole problem went away. But he was very frightened that he would be killed before any of that could happen. And matter of fact, before it could happen, he was indeed killed because everything that he was doing leaked out. Because his house was robbed, and most people suspect that this was done by Hollader, on orders from Hollader, who was trying to figure out how much Enstra knew, what Enstra was keeping in his house, what kind of information. And he found those notes about meetings that he had with his associates and Enstra. And basically he found out that Anshra was preparing to become a cooperator. So Anshra at one point was killed, shot in broad daylight in front of his office in Amsterdam. And that really shook up the Netherlands, because this guy was seen at that time as a legitimate businessman, sort of like Donald Trump, if you will. But with Donald Trump was seen as basically a bit different, maybe. But this guy was actually seen as someone who with knowledge about real estate, who made his own money, a lot of it, and who was able to expand and make it work. And he was actually on television shows explaining how he did what he did, and he was seen as a big success. And at one point, he kept denying that he had any ties to Hollander, and that was until this Quote magazine, this Dutch Forbes magazine, if you will, published a photo in which he was seen sitting on a bench outside his office next to Hollander in a discussion. From that point on, basically, he was seen as someone who could not be trusted. So people outside in the real world knew that this guy was not really saying, or not really the person that he claimed to be, the claim he was. And at that point, it was Hollander. He tried as much as he could to get as much money out of Anshra before finding out that Anshra was trying to cooperate. And then he probably, we don't know this for sure, but all signs point to it that he was killed on orders of Hollander.
So Hollander ended up going to jail, I believe, during this time, somewhere in the early 2000s or middle 2000s?
Yeah, correct. He was eventually arrested for these extortions, because they had these Anshra tapes, they were called, in which Anshra would talk to police about what Hollander and his associates were doing to him. And in 2006, they made several arrests, arresting Hollander and several Dutch gangsters and Yugoslavian gangsters in connection to these extortions. And Hollander was eventually found guilty of extorting Anshra and several other real estate tycoons, and sentenced to 9 years in prison.
So he's going to come out. Now, one thing I find kind of interesting, I see in your piece here, is he was a co-founder of a motorcycle club, No Surrender Motorcycle Club. But how did that figure in? He'd always been a biker, and had he ran with bikers. Bikers would be, they're pretty intimidating. They're pretty good guys to send out to intimidate real estate people.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing with the real estate people is that he didn't use the Hells Angels for that, but what happened was the Hells Angels did get involved in that. So No Surrender is a relatively new biker club, and I'll get to them later. But the whole thing started actually with the Hells Angels in Amsterdam, who were seen at the time as the premier Hells Angels chapter in Europe. They were basically seen as the leading chapter in connection to the Americans. And the Hells Angels in Amsterdam were very close to Willem Hollander. And the Hells Angels at the time were led by another Willem. This is going to get very confusing for all the listeners, but this was Willem van Bokstel. And he was the president of the Amsterdam chapter in the Netherlands. And he did not particularly like Willem Hollander. Hollander was seen as a power in the Amsterdam underworld, and also a power within the biker club. He had his own faction within the Hells Angels, despite not being a member. But he had very close connections to several high-ranking Hells Angels bikers. And at one point, Willem Anshra was so desperate that he contacted Willem van Bokstel. So we have Willem Anshra contacting Willem van Bokstel, the Hells Angels boss, about maybe trying to kill Willem Hollander in the Hells Angels clubhouse in Amsterdam, because Hollander felt safe there, felt secure. So Willem Anshra had the idea of putting a bomb in the clubhouse. Now, Willem van Bokstel, the Hells Angels president, did not condone this plan, but he also did not tell Hollander about the plan. So at one point, this came out, and his fellow biker brothers were just very incensed, were very pissed off that their own president had not told them about this plan. And he was kicked out of the club in bad standing. And from that point on, it was clear that Willem Hollander was much more than just a friend of the biker club, which they always claimed to be. So at that point, though he wasn't a member, people realized that Hollander's influence went much further than just the underworld of Amsterdam, and also stretched out into the biker world and community. And that was actually the first time that we saw Willem Hollander as a biker, because from that point on, it became clear to us that, you know, maybe he didn't have a vest, and maybe he didn't ride a bicycle or a motorcycle. He did, in fact, have enough power to mingle with these guys and tell them what to do. So that was a big thing that came out. And so later on in his life, I don't know exactly when exactly he got out for no surrender. Let me just check my... Yeah, he got out after the extortion sentence was served. He served two-thirds of his sentence, and he got out. And by that point, he was even more famous because, you know, what made his name in those days was the Heineke kidnapping. But after that, you know, having been in the media again with these extra tapes, the extortion racket, making millions more, everything else that came out during that time, because there was a lot of talk about gangland executions and hits that he was supposed to be involved in. So his name just rang throughout the country. And by that point in, you know, 2012, 2013, it wasn't just that his name was more famous now. It was also that the public in general, and I think this is the same in the United States and in Italy and no matter where you go, but we have so many of these crime shows, from Narcos to The Sopranos to The Wire. Gomorrah in Italy is a famous one, that the Dutch public was actually looking at Hollander as our guy. This was our Tony Soprano. This was our godfather. So he became kind of a media celebrity, and he actually had his own column in a national magazine, which came out weekly. For which he was paid, despite having to pay the government millions in pay because of his extortion conviction. So that was a very, basically people were like, is this okay? Should we do this? But despite all the negative connotations that it gave, people just kept on going. So he was on the radio. You had rappers making a song with him where he actually rapped a little piece. He was a guest in a program called College Tour, which is usually focuses on people who really made something of their life. So we have a Bill Gates, we have a Dalai Lama, we have Richard Gere, we had those kinds of people as a guest. And now we had Willem Hollander sitting there in front of all these students who could ask him questions. And that really, for a lot of people, that went too far. At that point, people were like, this guy was convicted of a violent crime, the extortion of all these guys, and some of them were shot, some of them were killed, and we have this guy on a pedestal, and we have him in these late-night talk shows, we have him on in magazines. What the hell is going on? But this was basically how famous he had gotten, and how this sort of like atmosphere in the world had changed, regarding this attitude towards gangsters and crime had changed, because people were like, he served the sentence and now it's done.
Well, Wiretappers, that will end part one of David Amoroso telling us all about the Dutch master criminal Willem Hollander. Next week, David will explain what happened to Hollander after his release from prison for the kidnapping of Freddie Heineken. Remind the listeners how they can view your work again.
You can go to my website. It's gangstersinc.org. You can find me on Instagram at gangstersinc. Find me at Twitter at gangstersincweb. And you can find me on Facebook. I think it's gangstersinc, just like that. I think you can, if you go to gangstersinc.org, you can find the links to any of the social media that I run. And you can read all the articles that I write and that other people contribute to the website as well.
Okay, David, thanks a lot for being on.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Well, that was our interview about a Dutch master criminal, motorcycle gang leader. I didn't really realize that he was so involved with the motorcycle gangs. Extortionist, member of a dysfunctional family, Wilhelm Hollander. He's quite a guy, and you might look for that movie, Kidnapping Freddie Heineken, with Anthony Hopkins, and I'm sure there's going to be more about this guy. He was the John Gotti, if you will, without the Sicilian mafia La Cosa Nostra aspect. He was a charismatic skinny Joe Merlino or John Gotti of Europe, and primarily in Holland. That was David Amoroso. He has Gangsters Incorporated website. He's a mafia expert calling in from Amsterdam. Now, as always, I thank you for listening to my podcast. If you have iTunes, please take a little time and give me a review. If you enjoyed what you hear and would like to support this podcast, please go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com. Hit the donate button. I've produced a documentary film, Gangland Wire, and written a companion book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. These works document the Kansas City mob and skimming from Las Vegas casinos. I have over 200 free back episodes of Gangland Wire for your listening pleasure. And finally, please don't forget about the Kansas City Mob Tour app. It's in the Apple Store. You can take your own personal tour of Kansas City mob sites. I've got places like where John Lazio was killed, where the Union Station Massacre was killed. There's maps. There's pictures. I've got places where Carl Spiro was killed. I've got pictures and stories about where all the important mob events happened in Kansas City. Good night, wiretappers. Music provided by our good friend and superfan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.